After widespread false claims of a stolen election in 2020 and the January 6th insurrection in 2021, there are major concerns about this year's presidential election. With election watchers worried about the kind of interference we could see in the days leading up to the election and the weeks afterwards. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. How secure are our nation's voting systems? What has history shown us about election interference? And how can we as individuals reject efforts to disrupt the democratic process? The Guardian reporter George Cheedy will explore some of these topics in an upcoming talk, The Power of the Vote, on September 26th at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. George Cheedy joins me now, along with Frost Brown Todd, LLP, attorney at law, and former Kentucky Secretary of State, Trey Grayson. Thanks for being here, George and Trey.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you very much.
Trey, what are some of the things that could go wrong in this election when it comes to election integrity?
So I think that one of the things I'm most looking out for is concerns about the certification process, where we've seen this a couple times in some local races, but where local boards that are primarily basically rubber stamps, they get vote totals, they make sure everything, the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, and they pass them up to state boards of elections or the equivalent.
And that's what the law kind of requires.
That's the law requires, yeah. And they need to do their job. And so one of my concerns is that some of these folks might take matters into their own hand. And some states are given a little bit more power to do some investigations. So State Board in Georgia is trying to do that. But I worry that even if we have accurate numbers that everybody agrees upon, that these folks at these local levels might not act, and that could create some challenges. It's a new one. We didn't really have this very much in 4 years ago. There was the one high-profile case in Michigan. But outside of that, this is a new one that concerns me about our elections.
Well, and, former President Trump still insists that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from him. You're a lawyer. You're a former Secretary of State.
Trey, and a Republican.
And a Republican, yes. Yeah. Have any of the court cases or claims related to that election made you question whether it was fairly or properly conducted?
No. I mean, all those cases, there were a couple that were up in the air. Like the one I think that some folks cite is Pennsylvania, whether ballots should have been counted if they were received after Election Day or not. That's an interesting policy question, and it's one that ought to be determined by the legislature, not by the courts. But it didn't matter. The number of ballots in question was a lot smaller than the margin of victory in Pennsylvania. So, no, there was nothing that we've discovered since the election, and there was nothing that was left dangling that would have put that outcome in doubt.
George, a number of states have been considering new rules when it comes to certifying elections, this process that Trey was just talking about. Explain what's been happening in Georgia.
So we have an election board here, five members, and three of them are what I'd call, I guess, Trump partisans, but coming from the election denier camp. They're still trying to relitigate 2020. They've demanded investigations that have long since been concluded. But they've also opened this door to questions about the certification. They've empowered local boards of election to do sort of an open-ended investigation if they find any discrepancies in the vote, on Election Day. And they're not defining any of this stuff well, which means the local folks can do whatever they think they want to do, which frankly will drag things out. And the fear is that it will delay things enough where results will end up in court and that a judge may not be able to make a ruling before the December 11th deadline, where all states have to have all of their disputes resolved before the electoral vote on the 17th.
So that's the impact that these new rules could have on the election. I want to ask you about the impact of another really disturbing fact that we have to deal with, and that's political violence. I mean, we just saw another reported assassination attempt over the weekend of former President Trump. What kind of impact, George, do you think this political violence could have on our democracy on this election?
So I'm worried. It's one thing when we're talking about somebody trying to kill a presidential candidate. I'm actually at least as worried about all of the rhetoric that's coming out around Haitian immigrants in Ohio as a trial run for terrorizing communities as early voting and voting starts. There's been this like long running conversation about non-citizens voting in elections, and now we've got this incredibly racist rhetoric going on, where I'm concerned that the attempted shooting of Donald Trump opens this big door to say, well, I guess it's on now, and then people trying to shoot at whoever they think is a political enemy, where it becomes vote suppressive. And I think it's a serious problem, and I think we should be looking much more closely at it.
Trey, what do you think about the impact this political violence could have? But also, could you speak to this claim that non-citizens vote and change outcomes in U.S. elections?
Sure. So let me take the second one first. It's against federal law for non-citizens to vote, to register to vote and to vote. There are a few communities in the country that allow non-citizens to vote in local elections. That's somewhat controversial, but that's a state local rule right now that the feds have not co-opted. It is probably not an accurate statement to say there are no illegal citizens registered, and it's probably not an accurate statement to say that no one has ever voted. And it bothers me when folks go that far. But it is clear from the evidence that we've seen that it's never made a difference in any outcome. So you have to be careful when you're describing the problem. But at the core, it is not something that we should be worried about. It's against the law. There's also incentives, because if you're a non-citizen and you vote and you get caught, or even get registered, you risk deportation. So there's some good incentives that they don't want to do it. And in fact, some inadvertently get registered. And that's a whole different conversation. Doesn't mean we shouldn't be vigilant and have good laws on it, but it's not something we should be worried about and talking about with the intensity that we are right now. On the Great. Going back to the first part of the question, you know, the other aspect of this political violence is maybe more not the extreme examples of the shooting, but just some of the rhetoric and some of the heat that's brought to election administrators. So Hamilton County Board of Elections employees in Ohio on my side of the river, county clerks, and I'm a poll worker. I work on the Saturday of early voting in Boone County. So if anybody listening from Boone County, I encourage you to come to the Boone County Richmond Center and I'll check you in if you have your ID
right,
and your register to vote.
All the right all documents. Stuff, yeah.
All the right things. But that worries me. I've seen when I was secretary back in the 2000s, there was some heated rhetoric, but nothing like this. I mean, secretaries, their staffs are getting death threats. We saw the women in Georgia whose lives were upended, the mother and the daughter who testified before the January 6th committee. That's a deterrent to just people volunteering, because essentially poll workers, you get paid a little, but you're essentially a volunteer. Those are the backs upon which we build our democracy. We need them to participate. We don't need them to be harassed out of those jobs that are essential.
Yeah. We're talking about election integrity and what experts are watching for in the weeks leading up to Election Day. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Trey, what do you think are the chances that we'll know the outcome of the presidential election on election night? I mean, should we all be prepared that it could take a while to know who wins?
My suspicion is that it'll take a while. Polls show that this race is a jump ball. If anything, it's even closer than the last two, according to the polling data. We still have some challenges. Pennsylvania, for example, can't really process their absentee ballots early. There shouldn't be as many this year. This is one of the positive things. We've been glooming and dooming, but the only thing I like to point out, we're not holding an election in the middle of a global pandemic. That's a really good thing. It'll make things better. But Pennsylvania still can't process their absentee ballots early. So if Pennsylvania's close, we could have a lot of ballots that aren't that haven't been counted yet. Arizona, another battleground state, a lot of their voters choose to drop their ballots off on election day. Takes a while to process those. So those are two battleground states. And Wisconsin, I think, also doesn't do the pre-processing. Three states where we may not have enough data to make calls. Now, the results are never official on election night. But I think since 2008, 2012, we went to bed knowing, and I guess even 2016, I think we went to bed knowing, if you went to bed
you
at 2 in the morning.
You stayed up late enough,
yeah. You went to bed knowing. So I wouldn't expect that. I think this one seems pretty close, and we'd rather be accurate But hopefully we can get that, you know, get those results quicker, because I think the longer it takes, it does tend to undermine confidence in the outcome. That's just a fact of life. So we always just joke in elections administration where we want large margins. Yeah. While votes still might be counted, but you knew who won, it would release some of that pressure.
Mm-hmm. George, as a reporter, what are you preparing for? You expecting a lot of long days and nights?
I'm already having a lot of long days and nights.
There you
like
go.
I'm counting my comp time in weeks at this point, like, because we can't get away from a weekend without something goofy happening.
Yeah.
And I am old enough to remember staying up until 3 and 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning with my mother, watching returns come in from Florida in the 2000 election. Like, it's new. I mean, we've kind of been here before. Mm-hmm. And statistically, like, with things as close as they are, one of those 8 states is going to be like, it's 12,000 votes and 5 million cast or something like that. One of those states is going to be close. And those are the circumstances under which all of the crazy rhetoric begins, where people are talking about votes being stolen or, you know, ballots going missing or whatnot. And it's almost always nonsense. Because there's, especially in this environment, there is no poll worker who's willing to put their life and livelihood on the line, like, to getting caught doing something crazy. I'm just saying, like, the standard for evidence for this is sky high. Like, and I, you know, because there are so many people watching. What do I expect? I expect in the days following the election for a return of the rhetoric that we heard after the 2020 election, assuming Trump loses. If Trump wins, I would not put it past Democrats to start asking some of the same questions, frankly, because that's the heated environment that we're in. And this is going to be something I'm going to be talking about when I'm in Cincinnati next week. Like, I'm worried about the quality of our democracy as much as its firmness. Like, what is it actually, how much respect or have we lost for the process? Like, because bad political actors have been pushing a narrative that undermines our faith in things that we should have faith in.
Did you want to add to that quickly, Trey?
No, go ahead and go to the break. It would be too long.
Okay. Well, we will continue our conversation after a short break. And later in the program, we'll hear about a new art exhibition that explores the transformative power of healing. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about election integrity and what experts are watching for in the weeks leading up to Election Day. My guests are The Guardian reporter George Chidi and Frost Brown Todd, LLP, attorney at law and former Kentucky Secretary of State, Trey Grayson. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk@wvxu.org. Trey, before the break, you were talking about certification and one of the things you mentioned was mail-in voting. How secure are mail-in ballots? There's been a lot of talk about that. I'd like you to address that.
Yeah, so we've been having mail-in ballots going back to the Civil War. It was actually the 1864 presidential election. President Lincoln needed those troops to vote in order to win, ironically, over a former Union general. So we've been doing it for a long time. Most states, not Kentucky, but the majority of states allow folks to vote by mail without an excuse. A smaller number of states still require an excuse. Whether you vote by mail, whether you vote in person, and whether you vote in person early or on election day, there's all there's safeguards in place in every single state. So we want to authenticate the voter. So vote by mail, that's usually, there's a signature or writing digits down of a social security number or driver's license ID. It's reviewed by a bipartisan team. So we authenticate them, just like when you check in at the poll. So we do that. And then they run the ballot through. There's also audits post-election to make sure the machines worked. There were audits before the election to make sure the machines worked. So vote by mail is something, like I said, it's been around for a long time. It bothers me. I'm not a huge vote by mail fan, and primarily because, and this is a whole other show topic, Eastern Kentucky has been a hotbed for vote buying at the local level for years. And it bothers me if we gave them more ability to vote in advance of Election Day outside of the polling places. But I don't have a problem with it if a state wants to do it. And like I said, they have these precautions and safeguards. I feel confident. I voted by mail before. If the situation presented itself, I would do it again. Mm-hmm. But it's something that shouldn't have, you know, President Trump used to always vote by mail. That's one of the ironies of him being against it. And I also say, as a Republican, we do a disservice to our candidates by discouraging people from voting by mail. This is a tool that we use successfully in many, many elections across the country. And we should be encouraging people to vote whatever is legal in their state. Mm-hmm.
George, let's talk about election observers. The Republican National Committee has been recruiting election observers around the country. What can you tell us about what they can and can't do and, you know, what the purpose of these election observers is?
So first, the Republicans have made claims that they're going to have 100,000 observers or something like that. And they're it does not look like they're getting anywhere near there. The idea here is that you've got somebody who's sitting in a poll who can see if there are gross violations of the law occurring. What they can't do is watch somebody vote. They can't take pictures of ballots. They certainly can't take pictures of people voting. Like, you show up with a camera in a Georgia polling place, you're going to get arrested. But the purpose there is to ensure that the processes that are legally mandated are happening, and that poll workers aren't breaking the law. And as long as that's all they're doing, then I think the process is actually good for democracy. I think it reinforces the idea that they're gonna go to polls and they're gonna see the perfectly normal things that everybody sees. The problems start when sort of innocuous issues like a machine goes down, and suddenly that turns into some, you know, the basis for a giant conspiracy about whether or not that poll was, that precinct was compromised or something like that. That's when we start to see problems.
Trey, the RNC has filed a variety of legal challenges across the country already. The DNC is hiring hundreds of lawyers in preparation for legal fights. What role do you think the courts are likely to play in this election?
The courts usually do a couple different things. So one is, there's sometimes laws and policies and regulations are not clear. So you go to court to try to clarify those laws. Ideally, that clarification takes place in advance of Election Day, well in advance of Election Day, so that we know, everybody knows the rules and has those expectations. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. I'll call that, that's probably the good part of the legal part. There's also the, I'm just throwing stuff out and seeing what sticks part of the legal process. We've seen a growing number of that. But there are a lot more attorneys nowadays, both parties, who specialize in election law. There's a lot more folks who are willing to pay those attorneys to file these kinds of suits. One of the silver linings that came out of the post-2020 litigation is we saw the most frivolous claims those attorneys were subject to, and are still, some of these investigations are still going on, sanctions by bar associations and bar authorities and Supreme Courts, have lost licenses, have had suspensions. That's a good deterrent. Everybody should get their day in court. We have contests and recounts and all these other procedures that exist, and you have the right to go pursue that, but you have to have evidence to make a colorful claim. You might lose. Losing doesn't mean sanctions, but when you're bringing something with zero evidence and you know it, that's worthy of sanctions. But it is something that we've seen, you know, going back. I mean, it was before 2000, but we all remember maybe not all of our listeners, we're getting old.
The
three
chairs.
Of us all, we all remember what happened in 2000. And that was really where we started seeing litigation become a primary strategy. One thing I want to just add about Georgia's comments about election observers: in Kentucky, we allow observers, but you have to go to training beforehand. That's really a best practice. I agree with them that observers can be good for transparency. I think training is a best practice, and all states should require that, which also requires some level of advanced registration. That's a way to get some of the good without some of the bad.
Hmm. George, proponents of these challenges by the RNC say they're all about keeping elections safe and secure, clarifying these rules and that policies. Opponents say they're about disenfranchising certain classes of voters. What do you think they're about? What has your reporting told you?
So we are tracking this national sort of movement around election challenges that's being driven by allies of the former president. We're in one case here in Georgia, the an elections board member in Fulton County is on the payroll of an organization in, I think it's Virginia, that has been looking to create interference in local elections. And she's filed a lawsuit, and the lawsuit is about allowing local boards of elections to, you know, withhold certification instead of being a ministerial function where their job is to say, yep, there was a vote. Here are the votes. This is what we've got. If you don't like it, let's talk about it in court. Like, that's how that's supposed to work. They're trying to change that. And I think it's because they want to be able to cast doubt if their preferred candidate does not win. I think we should be very wary of that.
Trey, what safeguards are in place now to prevent the kind of violence we saw on January 6th, 2021, and to ensure that Electoral College results aren't changed?
So one of the big developments since 2020 was the bipartisan passage of the Electoral Count Reform Act. So the Electoral Count Act was the ancient law that was passed in the 1800s after the 1876 election, where there were some questions about how to count the electoral votes. Law hadn't been updated, and it had some flaws. One flaw was all it took was one member of a chamber to trigger a debate. Democrats actually did this in 2000, 2004, and in 2016, but there was never a Democratic member of the other chamber. I think it was the House that triggered. Somebody filed a complaint, said, I have a question about this electoral vote from this particular state. It wasn't one from another chamber, so we never actually had the debates. 2020 took it to a whole other level. What this law does is it raises the threshold, requires a much higher percentage. I want to say it's 20%, might even be a little bit higher, of the members of both bodies have to say, I'm going to do this, and it also sets forth the grounds. So that's an important change that makes it harder. What Democrats had done had been more symbolic. They weren't expecting to really do anything, but it's much easier for a member of Congress to pontificate, to get clicks, to get headlines, knowing that there's nothing going to come of it. So we've raised that threshold, and that's a really important positive reform that should prevent something like a January 6th situation from happening. Now, one concern I have is, what if we don't have a Speaker of the House? This law was written as if there is a Speaker of the House, and we've seen that given the close majorities that Republicans currently have, may still have, or Democrats may have, it could be tricky to come to consensus. And if you don't have a Speaker of the House because they convene it the day before, that was not something was contemplated in this Reform Act. Can the House do business without a Speaker? We didn't at the beginning of this Congress. So there still are some risks, but we're in a much better spot legislatively thanks to that act by Congress.
Yeah. George, do you have faith in the U.S. election system?
I do. I very much do. It's not the election system that I'm worried about. It's built on the backs, and I say this with tremendous respect and love in my heart, of little old grandmothers showing up at polls and doing like 12 and 16 hours worth of work. I trust them. Like, I'm not worried about that. What I'm worried about is our broader politics. I think that the system is going to give a number that makes sense. I think that political actors will want to undermine that any way they can. That's what I'm worried about.
Trey, do you have concerns that voters are losing confidence? I mean, should voters be confident in the system? Do you have concerns that all this talk has made voters lose confidence?
So I think voters should have confidence for the reasons that George said. We have a good citizen system with transparency and bipartisanship baked in. We have security. We have, you know, tests of systems. Outside of Louisiana, most everybody has the ability to vote on paper. So we just really do. Our elections are better, more secure than they've ever been. It's our politics. It's what Republicans did, or too many Republicans. I don't want to give us all, you know, as members of the party, too many Republicans after 2020 did, and also Democrats after 2016 who couldn't fathom a Trump victory. You know, there's a lot of this politics, this litigation, this lawfare. That's a thing. The politics is a thing that concerns me. But voters, please the way you overcome all that is to show up and vote for your preferred candidate. Or if you don't have one, show up and leave it blank. That's okay too. But yeah, but go ahead, you know, to participate. We've seen that a lot of, especially local races, close margins, small number of votes cast because it's a small jurisdiction, you know, the votes do count. And so I hope folks do turn out in record numbers. We usually see that in presidential years, even a state like Kentucky, which has not been a battleground since really 2000, maybe 96. Ohio is now really not a battleground anymore. You know, we still expect 60% of the vote. That's what we had the last three presidentials in Kentucky. That's good. You know, it's good that we have, you know, the highest turnout this fall. And, you know, I think people should come out and do it.
Yeah. Well, and there are other races on the ballot for sure. That's
absolutely
not just the presidential race.
Yeah.
So. Well, I've been talking with The Guardian reporter George Cheedy and Frost Brown Todd, LLP, attorney at law and former Kentucky Secretary of State. Trey Grayson, thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
More information about George's September 26th talk at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center is available through a link on our website, wbxu.org. Up next, we'll hear about a new art exhibition that explores the transformative power of healing. This is Cincinnati Edition.